This is Mike Shea of SlyFlourish.com and Twitter.com/SlyFlourish. During this podcast, I'll be continuing my conversation with Dave the Game Chalker. Dave is the editor-in-chief of the Emmy Award-winning website Critical Hits and a freelance game designer for Wizards of the Coast. On previous podcasts, Dave and I have talked about his Paragon campaign, combat outs, and the 5x5 method. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the recent conclusion of his Epic Tier campaign, his experiences running Epic Tier, and his own tips for helping you run your own Epic Tier game. This podcast is about an hour long, and I hope you enjoy it. So, you finished your Epic Tier game.
I did. A little behind you, but you know.
Oh, yeah. Not everybody, you know, no one's perfect. The last time we've talked a few times in the past, and one of the times we talked about your Paragon tier campaign right as you had finished it and were heading off into Epic. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be good to get back together with you after you finished Epic and talk about what your experiences were there.
Yep, sounds good.
To start right off, what are your five biggest tips before we get into your game and let you talk all about it? What are the five biggest tips you have for running an Epic tier campaign that people might not have heard or people might not get? What were your personal experiences? The things you wish you would have done, or the things that helped you?
Right. Number one, you have to take kind of a more hardline stance than previous tiers about game breaking stuff. I think that's probably one of the big things we'll talk about. Go big or go home, you know. Don't be afraid to not pull your punches, throw everything at them, which is actually advice that I've always adopted since running Epic in third edition. You know, you may think that 17 beholders in a lava pit is overkill, you know. Don't pull back your punches, because they'll figure out a way. And emphasize the epic nature of it, because it's really easy to fall into a rut that's like, you know, here's five epic level demons, roll initiative, you know, and it just feels like the same thing as five goblins at level one, you know. Make sure that you're planning encounters and other story things that feel epic and feel different. Mm-hmm. I think it was five, give or take.
Is that five? Very good. Yeah, those are all very interesting. Can you talk more about the hardline stances? I'm always interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about, like, in your game, they kind of abuse critical hits, mm-hmm. Which, of course, is something I'm in favor of, but, you know. But in my game, there were a couple pretty insane combinations, which, you know, you try to, like, I don't know, I'm kind of wussy in that I hate to say, don't do that. Mm-hmm. And I try to speak to my players like adults instead of saying, you know, you're bad children, you can't be trusted, so don't do that, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, like, it really can get to the point that's just not fun for other players to be consistently overshadowed by one player, you know, or to have to throw threats at the party that decimate everyone except one guy, you know.
What were some of the combinations?
The one that was the most crazy in my game was also pretty insane at, you know, level 20, was the sword mage hybrid artificer, who was this insane defender, you know, AC and other defenses over 50, unhittable by epic monsters, you know. Mm-hmm. Was able to do like a ton of attacks in a round and do insane amounts of damage as a defender. Actually defender/leader, but also was better being a defender and a striker than some of the other dedicated ones. Mm-hmm. And the Avenger, the Diva Avenger, it's funny, it's my friend who posts the main event. Mm-hmm. We would talk about it, where, like, leading up to the finale of my game, he had an epic destiny, I think called Soul of the World, but it's basically like cherry pick powers from other races and other classes.
Wow.
And he was like, yeah, at this point, you know, it's in my best interest as a min-maxer to go back and completely rebuild my character from level one in order to get to this point. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I can optimally cherry pick powers. And then I get to look through every power designed for the game and, you know, come up with something that way. Or I could just level him and know that I'm not as powerful as I could be, but still actually pretty powerful.
Right.
So there gets to be some insane stuff.
Did you let him re-roll his character that way? Or did
I allowed it, especially because in my game we ended up jumping a couple levels.
Right.
And I said, you know, rebuild kind of the way you want.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately it was his decision not to do it because it would be like doing, you know, hours and hours of homework in order to play like one session, you know?
Yeah, right.
So
right.
It just wasn't worth it for anybody.
The time involvement wasn't, the time investment wasn't worth it.
Exactly. But he could have spent it and, you know, been even more devastating in combat.
Right, right. So now that we've talked a little bit about it, do you want to talk a little bit about your game? How did it go from, what was the lead in from Paragon to Epic? Generally, what happened during the Epic tier and what was your overall conclusion?
Yeah. So, the end of level 20
in 50 words or less, by the way.
Okay, I'll try and count. So they finished off the Temple of Elemental Evil and rescued a guy there, and the guy was like, hey, if you assemble the Rod of Seven Parts in this part of the Astral, you can potentially take out the Chain God. Mm-hmm. But the forces of the Chain God are also trying to recover it so that they can release him and it'll be unstoppable. You know, one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the campaign away from the, you know, the mortal realm, whatever you want to call it, the prime plane, and shoved them in a spelljammer and sent them to a far corner of the Astral so that they weren't really interacting with any of the rest of the campaign that had built up, except for some ties, basically kind of a restart, but with, you know, the same characters and,
mm-hmm.
you know, obviously the same big bad and some of the, a few of the returning villains from before showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started out, we played a couple adventures, and it became clear that nobody really liked playing in a lot of Epic.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount we wanted to do it, and we knew for a lot of us, you know, the sad realization is that, you know, this group is probably never going to play a full D&D campaign like that again. So we wanted to get all the way and have the full experience in some way.
Right.
But we really, you know, like me planning it and running it and them playing in it overall didn't really want to have that full, you know, grind your way through 10 levels experience.
Right, right.
So we ended up jumping around a couple levels, and then the finale ended up being halfway. It was like a all-day session, marathon session, where the first half of the game was 26th level. And then, you know, they assembled the Rod of Seven Parts and unlocked their Divine Spark, and they all advanced to 30 for the last. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got to play through 21 through 26, you know, a few adventures through that, and then those last two. So we skipped over a couple levels at the end and mm-hmm. pushed them together.
Mm-hmm. Your big bad was the Chain God?
Yep.
Did you stat him out?
I did, and did kind of a three-phase boss, and I don't know how well he worked or was particularly threatening to the party, but you know, I tried to make it that, like, I took level 30 or level 35 god stats and then made them even more damaging and insane, but also
right.
Not that tough to run. I should also point out that Danny Bartonius,
mm-hmm.
Because I had such a big group, I had him come in and run another table that encompassed that whole finale session. So
you had two tables running simultaneously?
Yep. One upstairs, cool. One downstairs.
Very
yep.
cool.
And so the first part of it at the lower level was more jump between locations, do kind of mini adventures to recover a piece of the Rod of Seven Parts. And then and they choose, you know, like, okay, you're gonna be on A team, you're gonna be on B team to go to this because it interests my character or because I think my character would be skilled for that, or just because they needed class balance, you know, or mm-hmm. Role balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last half was like, you know, here's the crazy fights against the Chain God's forces and the Chain God, with aspects of him kind of split between the two places that they kind of had to work together
right.
to beat. So
very
it was,
cool.
Yeah. So it wasn't just, it was actually kind of like designing five solo monsters.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, there were two stages at each table, and then like one, there was one very brief, huge encounter with like nine people at the table.
Right. It was nine people at the table and nine turns per round for each of the PCs.
We,
wow.
We only went through twice. I mean, it was like,
yeah, twice. That's about what, 2 hours?
We managed to keep it pretty snappy, especially because everyone was so exhausted by that point.
Sure, big marathon game.
The definition of marathon game has changed since, you know, we're in middle and high school.
Right, right. Yeah, right. Everyone's old. Yeah. I got kids that home I got to get to.
Yeah.
My back kind of hurts.
Yeah, precisely.
This chair not working well with my hemorrhoids. I'm gonna.
It was like midnight, you know. We were like, "Oh God, it's so late," you know.
Right, midnight. I'm very tired.
Yeah, I mean, we had been playing for almost 12 hours straight by that point. But,
sure,
you know.
Sure. Well, it's epic in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, exactly.
How would you describe your players? Are they? How would you? You know, of the typical player archetypes, is your group primarily combat heavy? Or do they like exploration and role playing? Is it a pretty good mix?
It's a pretty strong mix, I'd say. And you know, I had like one person who was primarily kind of combat min max focused, and that was really his main thing. And I had someone else who was combat focused, but also enjoyed a lot of story stuff. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of blurred all the way towards like, you know, one or two players who were like, oh God, combat, really, you know?
Right.
But the finale especially, it was a bit hard to mix a lot of the role-playing stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being, you know, a bit more combat focused, but with an overall story that I think worked for a lot of players.
Right. Very cool. So do you tend to run your games more from a story perspective or more from a combat perspective? Do you have a preferred kind of game that you like to run?
I tend to run more story focused games. D&D especially has more the combat stuff to it. It's like I'll come up with an outline and then, you know, go into either like compendium or even just dive around in my miniatures,
mm-hmm,
or the poster maps and figure out what encounters make sense,
right,
to go into that overall story arc. But I'm almost always starting from the story, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you probably noticed that I've been very big into poster maps recently, which is sad for a guy who's got three giant things full of Dwarven Forge. But
poster maps. A lot cheaper.
Yeah, they're a lot cheaper. They're a lot easier to deal with. And one thing is, something that I have not been able to do with Dwarven Forge is I can really say, hey, go wherever you want. And I'll just go through my map archive and find a map that works and throw it on the table and we'll figure it out.
Yep.
I'm trying to be much more of a lazy DM that way. And, you know, I think it works right along with what you're talking about, that you can let the story kind of drive things and then just kind of pick the map and the minis and, you know, reskin stuff from the monster manual or monster vault in order to determine. Well, then,
not only that, but the poster maps can be a really good source of inspiration by themselves.
Yep. Yep.
You know, you'll pick up like, oh, teleport temple.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that one. Yeah.
that one's, I think, is like that one and Broken Demon Gate are two, mm-hmm, of my favorites for like, oh, there's something really interesting happening here. Let's, you right, know, have right, that happen.
Yeah. I still love Calorel's thing in the bottom of Keep of the Shadowfell, you know, map with a big portal on one side and a big altar and all that. And
yeah.
Statue of Orcus. I think that you can use that for a lot of different things.
A lot of the ones that you steal from the modules, like, you know, several of them are kind of ordinary, but then one,
mm-hmm,
out of, you know, the set is really awesome for skilling.
Right. I'm just worried my group will eventually start to get bored of seeing the same locations, but I've got a lot of poster maps, so I think we'll be okay.
Well, and you can mix it up with other stuff too, but
right. Did you use the 5x5? And this is kind of a dumb question. How did you use the 5x5 method for your game, and how did it work out? How did it flow as you went?
Would it surprise you to tell you that I actually didn't use it for Epic?
It does. That's why I thought it was a stupid question. Why? You invented it. Why wouldn't you use it?
Yeah, exactly.
What's wrong with the 5x5 method? Why have you been writing about it all this time if you don't even use it for your own games?
I was kind of experimenting with pushing things more towards the sandbox end,
mm-hmm,
where I started with a map that was, you know, here are all the different locations. They're potentially where the Rod of Seven Parts is, and you choose where you're flying next.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I kind of took some of the lessons of 5x5, like always have your players chart a course at the end of a session so that you have the time to plan for the next one.
Right.
And, you know, it's always, you know, you have a general idea of the number of options that they have even before you start a session.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like they're going to say, okay, we're going to blow past this one that's right on the way to go to this other one because it's more interesting. You know, you always know, like, okay, it'll probably be one of the three closest locations is what they're going to hit next. Mm-hmm. So it kind of works out to 5x5, like some of the parts that way.
Right.
Overall, it, you know, I was trying to open it up a bit more. You know, there weren't as many steps for different plot lines. And, you know, it, in the end, it didn't really matter because we jumped over so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, whatever planning mode I had done would have kind of been tossed out at some point anyway.
Yeah. Did you hit a point in the campaign where you kind of said, okay, I'm going to start putting them closer onto the rails because I want to, you know, I want to start moving things along? Was there a moment like that with you where you, were you pretty much like the direction? I mean, Route of Seven Parts is itself sort of a nice plot device, right? Because
yeah,
it's exactly. Broken up into seven pieces. The seven pieces are out there somewhere.
And go find them.
Yeah, go find them. Yeah,
yeah,
two,
exactly.
You know, I don't care what order you do them in, but you're getting seven parts.
Yeah, that's why I like it a lot, actually. You know,
it's a nice.
It's not the first time I've used it, but it's, you know, it is a campaign mode in and of itself. You know,
right.
Collect all the pieces of
it's
the
got
thing.
A nice outline built in, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're plotting out your adventure, you can just go right from part one to part seven.
And
I actually don't know anything about the Route of Seven Parts.
Well, I think that's the beauty of it too, is I just make up crap. You know?
Yeah, that'll work.
Like, once you get past the name Route of Seven Parts, it's like, you can do anything. Like, I didn't use the artifact rules that have been printed for it in fourth edition at all.
Mm-hmm.
I tied each piece into the story. So like each piece of the rod had the name of, you know, an NPC from the past, mm-hmm. that tied into primarily one player's backstory, although it kind of touched some others.
Right.
And, you know, and I was like, okay. And then because it's associated with this NPC, it has this power, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just went from there. So I didn't really set them on to rails until that final adventure, you know.
Right.
But like leading up to it, I was like, okay, you know, we're going to go through this one that we had already planned on doing. And at the end be like, Gene God's escaping, better hurry, you know. And then like next adventure was frantic collecting the remainder of the parts and then, you know, going to the final battle.
Right.
So it's something that I could have spread out, you know, like it. I basically took the elements that I was going to plan and, you know, force them into a single adventure, you know.
Right.
Like I crammed, you know, five, six adventures into one half of a marathon session.
Sure. Do you have any general observations about the epic tier now that you've been through it?
Yeah, I'm kind of down on it, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just some of the rules stuff. And, you know, there's, I think, a lot of fair criticism about there's not enough support. There's not enough monsters.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say there's not enough advice. But of course, you know, we have your book.
Well, there's a reason why I wrote it. And that's because there wasn't any.
Exactly. But to me, I think it represents a deeper issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really think Epic would work better if it were maybe five levels tops.
Really?
Yeah, because there's
just too big.
Yeah, I mean, there's not enough stories and interesting things you can do with Epic to me to spread out over 10 levels.
Right.
And so, you know, if I were doing it again, I'd probably try to compress it. But I also feel like it would work better. And this goes back to kind of my first and second edition experiences with the old Immortals rules and whatnot.
Right.
Where you have a level that you get to an epic that's like, okay, we've finished the campaign in a way. You know, you've beat the big bad and the players are kind of going, their characters are kind of going their separate way.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can play out a few kind of epilogue adventures where, you know, this character becomes a god and, you know, like fulfilling their epic destinies, but in a way that doesn't get capped off by the actual adventuring epic play. And then, you know, every player gets an adventure that's like his epic quest and immortality or whatever.
Right.
So I think it needs a restructuring, because, you know, once you, like, if I were to cram all the interesting epic monsters into five levels, you know, adjusting their challenge levels, you know, their monster levels as needed, I think that would be, you know, I'd get a lot more out of it, because then I could have more variants. But at the moment, there's so few epic monsters in the first place that really are well designed that, you know, that was part of it too, that I was having to rework stats on the fly a lot.
Yeah, right.
And even getting past that point, there just wasn't as many that were interesting that were powering stories, that were like, this encounter can anchor, or this monster can anchor an encounter in an interesting way.
Right.
Just wasn't any of those.
Right, right. Yeah, I disagree with you in some regards, or my experiences are different, I should say. Not only did I have enough material to take him from 21 to 30, leveling every other or every third adventure, but I still have storylines going. They've been level 30 now for 3 or 4 adventures, and we're done with it. I retired the campaign. I called it done. I wrote a big article on Critical Hits about being done, and then I keep finding myself going back again. And the group keeps finding themselves going back. And as soon as I say, okay, next week we're going to have another Shield Basher run, their eyes light up and they all get excited to dust off their 30th level characters and go running around.
Yeah.
Beating on things again.
That's sort of, I don't know that those are incompatible though. Mm-hmm. Like the 10 levels leading up to it is one thing, but I would prefer Epic, like as a suggested campaign model,
right.
Okay, your campaign ends at level 25.
Right.
But then here's god levels afterwards. Yeah.
I see what you mean.
They're not designed to run through.
They're one shots in more than a campaign, but they have kind of a general story arc that's tying them together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's more epilogue type stuff to hit.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. I obviously I like the Epic tier enough, or I wouldn't have, I wouldn't keep writing about it. I think it's because those storylines resonate with me. I look at it and say, the outer planes, the astral sea and the elemental chaos and the abyss and the nine hells and stuff like that. They're not really the place they're certainly not the place for heroic unless you're diving in and diving back out again. Mm-hmm. And in Paragon, even Paragon tier, pit fiends would be looking at you, be winking at you before they kill you.
Mm-hmm.
But Epic tier gives you this full 10 level range to explore this whole kind of outer sphere of the plane of your hamburger. And I kind of like that. It was a lot of fun and I had I ran the traditional, the full adventure series, heavily modified, but it gave me a pretty good arc right off the bat. And there are parts of it that I probably wouldn't have done again, but there were some parts like the Kingdom of the Ghouls and Thanatos and stuff like that. I guess it's excited me when I was 14 and it excites me now.
Right.
So okay. I was happy to run that.
See, I like a lot of that outer plane stuff too, plane hopping kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost feel like each one is, a limited number of hooks so that, at least with my players, or at least with the way I tend to run them, it's like I can say, okay, this adventure's in the abyss, and I can get, an adventure or two out of it,
mm-hmm.
With the overwhelming scariness and there are demons right. everywhere and blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right.
But I can't support more than that,
Yeah.
It's like,
I think I ran about 6 adventures just in Thanatos, 6 nights or so just in Thanatos, which is Orcus's homeworld in the Abyss. And I stole a lot from Throne of Bloodstone, the old first edition, which is a ridiculous module, right? That was the module that was level 15 to 100 character level. But it was a lot of fun kind of taking him through. They got to ride in the River Styx, and they got to, my favorite bit was there was a temple that they had to go through. That was the temple that Orcus's high priests would go through as a test. So the party had to go through the tests of the high priests of Orcus in order to get through to Orcus's castle.
Oh, yeah. There was one of the other modules has something similar to that, too.
Yeah,
the heroic or paragon wand.
Right. So I had the fun then. And I agree. Well, I don't think there's a lack of epic tier stuff, epic tier material, particularly with monsters. When you look at the Monster Manual 3 and the Dark Sun creature catalog, they have a fair bit of epic tier. I will say that I don't think those guys work that well. I don't think they'll stand up. And I think the reason why is your group will find a whole set of broken things that will make all of those battles trivial.
Mm-hmm.
And my group has a whole different set of things that make those battles trivial.
Right.
And there isn't, there's no way in the book to handle them all. There's just too many weird things. Like,
I also feel like, to me, and this is probably one point where we diverge, that having epic level monsters that are standard monsters, or like they're not elites or solo. Yeah,
right.
It's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah. No, I get you.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
And so it's like I would go flipping through Monster Manual 3 or Dark Sun, or even Rob Schwalbe has a ton of really good epic monsters up on his site.
Yeah,
for free.
Right. Right.
So like I go looking through those and I'd be, okay, you know, here's like the mummy that spawned all other mummies or whatever, you know,
right.
like something with a really interesting and epic story. Mm-hmm. And then we'd get onto the battlefield and we'd be like, okay, it's got a mummy slam and, you know, necrotic aura.
Oh,
you know?
No, mummy disease.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's the same
but it's
thing
epic as, level.
Right,
you know?
It's the same thing as the ones they fought before.
Yeah.
That's probably true. And I think one thing that saves me is my group was interested enough in the mechanics that they just wanted, you know, they'd have been happy with practice dummies. Mm-hmm. For a lot of the combats, they just wanted to watch their characters work, and the more battles I gave them where they could just watch their characters work, you know, the better off they were. They had that, you know, they had my wife played a ranger, and one of the abilities she got kind of mid epic level was the ability to hit every single thing she could see with a shot in one
right.
in one power. And so I gave her a huge open field full of minions, you know, and she got to kill like 45 minions in one round.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, they didn't I don't even know if they had stats, you know, they had an AC and that was
right.
kind of
that's
it.
All they needed.
Right. And they, I think they even transformed, like she'd kill him and then the guy would raise him and dead, you know, and they turn into skeletons and then they'd kill him again. So,
yeah.
You know, it was, but a lot of it was that the fun for the players was just kind of watching things work. And the fact that they were really not that much different than minions at level 5. You know, other than these are the all of the corpses of the high priests of Orcus that have been returned to Thanatos instead of, you know, goblins in a tunnel. It didn't matter too much for him. But yeah, it does seem kind of counterintuitive. Like what is an epic mook?
Yeah.
You know, what sense does that make? Either the guy's really, really powerful or he's not. How do you have hundreds of guys that are level 29? You know,
You know, there are kind of two key differences with our groups here. The first being, because I had such a large group, I was only running them chunks at a time.
Right.
Whereas yours, you know, was pretty much set, right, from week to week.
Yeah, we played pretty much every week.
Yeah, so, like, you had the same group of people, you know, who had all their teamwork things worked out and everything.
Yeah, much to my chagrin.
Right. Whereas, you know, my groups definitely worked together and they were familiar with all their characters, but it wasn't like, you know, the oiled machine by the time they got to epic tier.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Especially with characters having come in at various points during the storyline before that.
Yeah. I mean, I had a little bit of that. We had one guy who kind of switched characters a few times. We had a couple of players that left and a couple new players that came in throughout. You know, I think we had one person that came in during the epic tier, but I think everybody else was. And then we had a bunch, probably half of the group had been playing since level 1 all the way to 30.
Right, so a lot of that, you know, they had enough time to really click and stay the same from week to week, whereas my group changed a bit. And I also, I guess kind of the way that I run and like to describe things is, you know, like if a player's got a power to kill everything on the board, you know, I'll want to show that power off like a few times.
Right, right.
But not every adventure, you
yeah,
know?
Exactly. I like to show it, you know, I like to do two things. I like to show it off once, and then I like to make it painful for them next time.
Right,
which is,
yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, so the first time they get to kill 45 people in one shot, the second time, for every person they kill, the group takes 5 necrotic damage. You know, and then, oh my god, we just took 450
necrotic
damage.
Stop shooting, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm gonna kill them all, but if I kill them all, we're gonna take ongoing 75 damage.
Yeah. Knife players that would say, "Oh, it's totally worth it. I killed them all."
Yeah, we did. It was quite an interesting debate. You know,
yeah.
I don't know if I told you about it. It was an altar. I'll probably write about it. It was an altar that for every dead creature in the room, it got stronger. Like a, you know, its aura got stronger.
Right.
So they're like, "Well, we're either going to take a bunch of damage from a bunch of level 30 minions, or we're going to take one big amount of damage from an altar that's been fueled by a bunch of dead minions."
Mm-hmm.
So you know, so hey, either way, you're going to take a lot of damage.
Yeah. And the big thing with those is that they have, you know, a strong hook to them, you know, both of those encounters, like, oh, this is new and interesting.
Yeah.
Whereas I felt like a lot of epic stuff, you know, like it has to be suggested through the, you know, how the mechanics or the lore or whatever, why this is different.
Mm-hmm.
There just wasn't enough variety for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, going back and kind of upgrading some of the older monsters, worked a bit, you know, where I was able to say, like, you know, we were able to use some of our favorite epic monsters from way, way back and upgrade them and be like, okay, you know, you're finally getting to encounter the undead god fetus.
Yeah, right. The Atropal. I love the Atropal.
Yeah, yeah. I think that might have been the capstone of my campaign is when I worked in to have the Atropal make total story sense. Like, everything had been leading up to that.
Right.
It was actually the son of one of the player characters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when it was revealed, everyone was like, oh, you know.
That's grisly.
I would say, like, that was the key moment.
Sure.
But that's the thing. Like, that was that's an interesting monster that's got, like, a story behind it. Right. And also, like, oh, it constantly raises the dead around it and has, like, necrotic eye rays and all this other crazy stuff.
Yeah, right, you know? Right.
Easy for me to build something around that. But then I still had to tap into the well of, like, and here's an epic level wraith, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's like the essence of the whole universe, right. You know, that kind of thing to support it. But overall, it just was kind of lacking for me, you know, the interesting level of monsters.
Right, right. I mean, I you know, I agree with your initial assessment on that, which is, you know, you're kind of down on the epic tier. I'm actually kind of down on it, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is sad because I'm, you know, I wrote a book about it. And we'll get to my book in a moment, but I just, you know, I think, like, D&D can, you know, somebody can go to the store and they can pick up the Dungeon Master's Kit and the you know, the Essentials books, and they can kind of sit down, they can figure out how to play D&D, and they could play 1 to 10 without any real problems, right? You could play with the stock monsters, you could play with stock encounter ideas, you could play with published adventures, and, you know, other than tweaking it a little bit around the theme of your group, you could do without too much trouble. Running epic tier, probably high paragon to epic tier, you pretty much have to be a designer.
Yeah,
right. The rules don't work anymore, and you're gonna have to figure out things all on your own, and you're gonna have to, like, look at, you know, what World of Warcraft does with encounters, and you're gonna have to look at all these other areas, and you have to get a lot of inspiration, and you're gonna have to build stuff, and that just doesn't, you know.
Yeah, it's work.
Yeah, right. It's hard work. For sure. People don't want to do that.
Yeah, you know? I agree. And, you know, to an extent, they shouldn't have to.
They shouldn't have to. Right. Right. Why? Yeah, why does it get? Why does it go so crazy?
And, you know, this isn't something that's new to D&D as a whole, you
right
know?
Right,
like, the closer you got to 20, the more insane it got anyway, you
yeah
know?
So, yeah, right. I don't think I ever got through a 3.5 campaign that was higher than, like, level 12, and it was because, you know, suddenly mind fog is ruining every battle I ever ran,
right?
So yeah, that's certainly true. I still, you know, any criticism I give to 4E, it's still it's the best D&D system I've used. You know, it's the best D&D system I've run. I still love running it. I'm gonna play as long as I can, you know, and run weekly games. But I'm probably gonna stick to 1 to 10.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'm done with anything higher than 10. I'm running one Paragon campaign now, and then I'm gonna go back to 1 to 10.
I still feel like if they had done, like, previous editions had done and said, okay, these books are for 1 to 20, and then, you know, made an epic book.
Mm-hmm.
That had all that stuff. They could have focused on it more, and there was less of this expectation,
right,
that it's going to work for.
Yeah, right. Levels, I mean, you were at the same Gen Con I was at, where they said 1 to 30 is the new sweet spot for D&D.
Yeah,
and everyone in the room that was already groaning about everything else, you know, said, "Hey, they just turned it to 11." You know, and everyone else is like, ah, sweet spot, right? You know, and it turns out, no, there is a sweet spot. It's like 1 to 5.
I don't know.
The sweet spot's at the beginning of the game and gets worse from there.
Yeah, I give it more leeway. I mean, I had a lot of fun running some of the early Paragon stuff, too. But
yeah,
it definitely, the higher you get.
Paragon, for me, particularly when the gloves were off, when they were allowed to choose whatever they wanted to choose, and before item rarity and other things. Paragon was immediately where I started to see things like damage resistance was, you know, negating entire battles.
Yeah.
And, you know, our rogue was able to, meat grind people to death into a wall of fire, you know, with a slide 5, and they take 110 points of fire damage, you know, at level 11. That's where I started to see things really start to get a little freaky.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should point this out in the context of running epic games that I had gotten really sick of the whole item thing, which, you know, it's one of my foibles with game systems. I really hate equipment stuff in general anyway. But, you know, by the time they were at 20, it was like half the party had the Dice of Auspicious Fortune because anyone could use it, and, you know, it's really good.
Right.
and some of the other boosting items, like you have to take these, and then, you know, it dilutes everything.
Right.
And it also increases the power level pretty highly, you know.
Right, right.
So we got to Epic, and I was like, you're in an area where magic items basically don't work, you know. Have these inherent bonuses, which I think is an awesome rule.
Yeah.
And you can have, like, two items on top of that, you know, to stack with it.
Yep.
But nothing else, you know.
So right, right.
Choose the two things that are most important to you as far as magic items go, and then you have nothing else.
How did your group feel about that?
There was a bit of complaining, but I think a lot of them, especially the ones that had abused it, understood why, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, it sped things up a bit, too, where I was able to, like, you weren't having to figure out, like, oh, now I have twice the number of powers I normally have because I have all these items.
Yeah, right.
You know, we were able to do with that away with that entirely, and you're able to just follow along with the powers you selected from your class, which, you know, work, like, if you're a wizard, you know what your wizard powers are going to do in general.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas item powers are like, oh, and you can fly and reroll and make a melee attack, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. My Dark Sun campaign, where we used inherent bonuses, was much easier. And I gave away some magic items, but it was very rare.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that worked out. Do you have? Let's talk a little bit about the encounters that you ran. I'm a big encounter buff. Mm-hmm. How long did they run? How long were your typical epic level encounters?
You know, I made a concerted effort to keep them not that long. So I would say wasn't really any longer than the Paragon ones.
Which is about what?
Under an hour, unless it was a really big
really?
Thing. I mean, some cases it was closer to like a 45-minute thing.
Really?
Yeah, a fair amount of time, I'd say.
How many rounds did you manage to squeeze out in 45 minutes to an hour?
It's like
half a round for my group.
Probably in the 4-ish range.
Hmm.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That's pretty good. And was it all using the famous Dave the Game combat out?
That was a lot of it. And, you know, people gelled more with their characters, I think, which helped. So I said eliminating their, a lot of the items to, you know, tailor down some of the options.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy, I think only one person in the group at Epic was playing an Essentials character.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, his turns were really snappy, you know. Yeah.
What was he playing?
Slayer.
Yeah, I love Slayers.
Yeah, he was able to dish it out, you know.
Sure. Oh yeah, they're powerful, but they're nice for a DM.
Yeah.
You know, they're not one of the inhibitor class types. And
yeah, well, he actually did say he felt a little restricted compared to the other characters. Like, he wasn't able to do as many things,
yeah,
but
right.
He was still consistently dealing out tons of damage and was taking real, real quick turns, you know?
Yeah, sure, sure. He came in later. Did he level the Slayer? Was it he or she?
He came in with the Slayer at 21. He had played different characters at lower levels.
Okay, yeah.
But it was a new character for 21.
Yeah, one of the criticisms that I hear from people that read through the Essentials classes is they're not sure they are interesting enough to play all the way from 1 to 30. Do you think that was true with him? I mean, playing 21, you know, 21 to 26 and then, you know, jumping up to 30, was he interested enough in his character throughout that time?
Yeah, I don't know if he was hugely into it, but I can definitely see that having crept in after a while, but I think the campaign length was mm-hmm. short enough that didn't really crop up.
Right, right. Can you talk about some of the combat outs that you used for some of the battles that you ran?
Sure.
I always love combat out examples.
I can tell you about my favorite one, which was in that finale adventure for sure. So you had the two tables set up, right? You know, half the party was on one, half the party on the other. And they were told specifically, okay, one of you guys is on defense. The hordes of the Chain God are coming through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, face them on this magical bridge, basically. Hold them off for as long as you can while the other group is trying to push through bad guys in order to plant the Rod of Seven Parts mm-hmm. and do some mojo with it, right? It turned out that the force that they had to get through on the offensive was Orcus.
Yay.
So half the party was fighting Orcus. In fact, your improved Orcus.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to ask you about that.
And they were they were level 30 by that point. But
right.
It was still only like four characters
mm-hmm.
Who were trying to get past him in order to do a thing. Whereas the rest of the party was fighting, you know, powerful monsters showing up every single round.
Right.
And so the out was, you know, the upstairs group finishes what they were doing, but anything that broke on through, you know, would come to the other group, attack, and, you know, would start to kind of overwhelm, you know, like coming from the rear, attacking while Orcus is in front of you.
Right.
And so there was, and they could teleport between the two locations at a certain point. So, you know, at one point they were like, oh crap, we're fighting Orcus. The wizard is on the other team. We need him up here to cast mass resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to wait for him, you know, to be able to make his way to the point, switch, cast, and then, you know, jump back or not. And then there were other people that they had to borrow from the other table, you know?
Right, right.
And so it was kind of an interesting balance, you know, between getting to the objective, but also not letting hordes of crazy powerful monsters through
right.
that wipe out everyone.
Right. Which version of Orcus did you use?
Not the super powerful one. The one, I think he had like the altar rules.
Yeah.
Just like the other right. one that was on that same post.
Yeah, so I had a 33. That's more like a revision of the one that's in the Monster Manual 1. And then I had the 35 Orcus God of Death version.
Yeah, it was the 33.
Yeah, yeah. The 33 was my test one where I wanted to see what the party would do against Orcus. So I had a fake version of Orcus that they fought.
Mm-hmm.
And they beat him down pretty badly.
You're like, more damage.
Well, and then this one I learned, okay, yeah, you know, this one I learned, so the whole we get free hits off of every critical hit needs something. And that's when, you know, the glorious fire shield came in so that every time anybody hit Orcus, they would take 35 fire damage.
Right.
And that helped a lot until they run around and, you know, screw around with altars until they stop working.
Right. Figured it out eventually.
Yeah, well, they figured it out right away.
Yeah.
It took them about 3 seconds ago. We got
like, oh.
Everybody, we got to go dick with the altars.
Right.
We're not going to be able to beat him until we do. And it gave him 4 rounds to go beat on players. So he had his fun.
Good enough.
Yeah, right. Right. He got to use his touch of death, and that was all good.
Yeah, in that game, it was a table Danny was running, but he got to use touch of death and kill people off, which is cool.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any specific tips for running epic tier combat outs?
I think that at least for my game, a lot of the ones at Paragon had kind of worn themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, running away isn't quite as interesting at epic, for instance.
Yeah, I've never had much luck with a runaway on either side because they just don't. You know, I've seen a group that will spend an hour trying to figure out how to stop guys from running away.
Right,
and it's just tiring. Like, I'd rather they just disappear in a cloud of dust.
Right. Well, you can do that too.
Yeah, I've done that many times. Like, I guess
an enemy wizard who's bloody. He's teleporting.
Right.
That's what wizards do.
He's gone.
You know?
Yeah.
I'll talk about one of the other ones from my game that I really enjoyed. I think is some examples. So they went up against the Tarrasque.
Oh yeah.
And I have this nice poster map from Jared von Hinman. That's the interior of the Tarrasque.
Oh really?
Yep. The tract of the Tarrasque.
Oh wow.
And so it was a two-front battle where there was, like, the outside that's the insane killing machine.
Sure. You know,
with claws and biting and everything else. But then the only way to really stop him was to get swallowed, you know, which is, like, more automatic damage and stuff every round.
Yeah, right.
But there was an objective in there. They're actually, like, organs of his that they had to hit with force movement powers in order to disrupt it. So
wow.
I think some of those things that caused the party to have to think, you know, more so than obviously just kill, but also like, what's the trick here? And forcing them to make new tactical decisions based on, you know, what the objective is pretty important, you know, and in some of the cases it involves like having to split up and do, you know, things on multiple sides that require specific party members, you know. So like if you say the wizard has to be the one to go inside, you know, but the wizard is squishy and can't take that much damage. So then that starts to shape, okay, this is how we handle this, you know.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I ran a Tarrasque as well, but mine wasn't nearly as it wasn't nearly as cool as that, you know, although it's kind of a similar effect, but there wasn't this whole separate track. We had a, you know, the fighter got swallowed by the Tarrasque. He had 30 acid resistance, so he had no problem surviving being inside the digestive tract of a Tarrasque.
Right.
And he was considered adjacent because he's internal, and thus the Tarrasque was slowed the whole battle. It's like, oh, he's so heavy. You're like,
right.
Boy, what did I eat? And it worked out. Everyone had fun, and the Tarrasque still got to use like his Vorpal Bite on people, and you know, it was another souped up version. It wasn't the one from the Monster Ball.
Right.
Monster Manual.
I ended up mostly stealing from Ogre Mach powers.
Yeah, I actually used Ogre Mach as one of my reskins for Timesis, which is one of the main villains in the whole E3, you know, H1 through E3 series.
Mm-hmm.
Timesis is this weapon, I forget, I don't remember, some weapon of ultimate destruction that was designed to destroy the Chaos Shard.
Right.
And I used Ogre Mach for that. And the unfortunate thing is that I wanted my group to fight Ogre Mach, and it was exactly the same.
Right.
Now that you've gone through Epic, if you were to run an Epic game again, would you put more character limitations in place? Would you, you know, open it up free reign? You know, how would you alter the character creation process?
Yeah, I think the same way that I'd limit even other tiers of campaign play,
mm-hmm.
where I encourage essentials but don't require it. Like, there are benefits to playing essentials characters,
mm-hmm.
Especially just because, you know, it makes things a bit snappier and it's a little easier to, you know, work out some of the combinations. But also, if you really want to play one of these other character archetypes,
mm-hmm.
you know, the option's still there. It's just not quite as incentivized.
What incentive do you use to get people to play essentials?
I'm still working out the details, but you know, like for character creation stuff, actually being able to bump up stats might even be an option, or starting with like a slightly higher item, or like both incentivizing the classes that I want people to play and the races too. So like, you know, okay, you can be, you know, the build of the fighter from the player's handbook, but you can't be any like weird race, you know?
Right, right. Like,
you're gonna be human, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Like, nothing game breaking, mm-hmm. but just a slight bump in, you know, effectiveness, I guess.
Right, right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I tend to have a much more, you know, rigid approach. I'll just say these are the races and classes that are allowed for this particular campaign.
Right.
And, you know, essentials is almost always allowed, and then, you know, some other things from time to time.
Right.
My latest one, that's they can unlock player races and classes that they want to use,
yeah,
by quests in the game.
I think I would use that too.
It's also a nice alternative reward.
Like, if, you know, with my game, it's okay, we're playing this campaign and it's gonna last a while, you know, whereas, you know, you're playing every week, which is more often than I play,
mm-hmm.
and you know, with the same group of people, so you know, if you're going to get the chance to play more stuff, like, it's not a big a deal to players,
right.
I think.
Right.
But if I'm saying, like, you know, with this campaign, it was like 3.5, almost 4 years that, you know, probably closer to 3.5 years that we were playing the same game,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to say, like, no, you can't play this for the entire right. 3.5 years, you know, stings a bit more.
Yeah, the funny thing is, for my Epic tier campaign, I had no limitations on anything, so all the items, all the classes, all the races. I didn't put in place like the anti-crit or the, you know, any of the house rules that I would have liked to run. I did not, because I said they've spent too long doing this for me to limit them like that.
Right, right.
But then I put all the limitations on every campaign we've played since, which have all been low level, so they weren't nearly right. as important. You know, when I tell people that, you know, you can never crit on anything but 20 unless a environmental or, you know, environmental or encounter effect allow it. Well, that doesn't matter at level 5 because nobody can.
Sure.
They yell and we yell at each other, and then they realize that it doesn't matter.
The other thing that I really thought worked well at Epic that I would probably do again is creating more custom stuff for players, or working with players to create custom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to let you have the game-breaking combo that lets you make 40 attacks.
Right.
But, you know, we can collaboratively design a really cool power.
Mm-hmm.
that only your character has, you right, know? So right. then once a day you get to do this awesome thing, but it's still in something that I can expect, you know, and yeah. it's going to affect every single fight.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. One of the things I found is that even I ran some play tests of stuff with Epic level essentials characters,
mm-hmm.
and it still can be just as debilitating.
Yeah.
Like they're better and they're more streamlined, but there's still a lot of lockdown.
Right.
You know, that can occur mostly in environmental terrain. You know, terrain lockdown was something that I saw a lot with essentials characters that, you know, one has to deal with when one is designing epic tier monsters or encounters or things like that. So probably the most important question, out of, on a scale of 99% to 100%, how useful was running my book, Running Epic Tier Games, available at slyflourish.com/epic?
I think I'm going to go with the 99.3674%.
Yeah, I think that's pretty unfair, frankly, and I'm insulted.
Well, there was a page with my name on it, so
that's true. So that
clearly could not be helpful.
That didn't push it. Yeah. Oh, so it's more self-deprecation than
right.
Yeah, you like any book that would have me in it can't be any good.
Right.
I got you. Exactly. Yeah. Groucho Marx, I think.
Yeah.
Felt much the same way. Did you have any other final thoughts for people that are running Epic Tier Games? Anything that you want people to really remember?
I think you kind of put the nail in it that you really do kind of have to be a game designer at that point. You know, the tools that are provided for you are only going to go so far.
Mm-hmm.
I got more traction out of it than I thought by coming up with, I basically sat down and thought, okay, what are things that I consider epic, you know, that are appropriately mythic, and, you know, going back even to kind of Greek myth for some inspiration and other inspirations that way. You know, I spent a lot of time brainstorming that, but then I really had to say, okay, I'm going to have to invent a lot of the mechanics and a lot of the structure, because mm-hmm. it's just not there now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, while there are plenty of monsters from old books, like there's lots of stuff I really like in the Astral Sea book,
mm-hmm.
but it's all going to get updated to new monster math, or else it's really going to be unsatisfying.
Right. I was actually just using that book the other day, and you read through it and just shook my head.
Yeah.
It's like there's a lot of really good fluff in there. The crunch is useless.
There's so many monsters in that I've loved from previous, you know, iterations, like in previous editions of D&D that, you know, had I not bumped up, would just be worthless, you know?
And then, unfortunately, I think it needs more than just damage. Like, it's pretty easy to pull out your damage per level chart and just update the damage, but I don't think it's enough for a lot of these guys.
I agree.
I think, you know, there's so many, and I don't know that I haven't found many that are perfect. You know, I haven't.
Yep.
I don't think, I mean, like the new dragons that are in Monster Vault are really good, but they don't even have high level versions of those.
Yeah. In fact, for that finale, I had one of the fights was, you know, I used the big red miniature, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
because I paid $50 for it. I'm going to get as much use out of it.
I watched you drag that thing across country to
use it in that's what I'm saying.
DM challenge.
So of course I had to have the fight against that. But and the Monster Vault dragons are really good, but yeah, it's like they only go up to 20.
Right.
So I kind of had to look at the original monster manual, level 31,
mm-hmm.
and then say, okay, what can I steal from 20 to make this more competitive?
Yeah.
And it worked out pretty well. And it was also kind of an interesting environment and all this other stuff, and I actually like used the blue sticky tack, so people were like jumping on the dragon, like running around it.
Yeah, that's cool.
And so I was actually like sticking their miniatures on the dragon itself.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of thing, you know, where if I had just thrown the level 30 dragon at them, like they would just wipe the floor with it, you know.
Right.
And a lot of the problem actually is that it's so unsatisfying because it's not going to be a challenge to the players, but it's also going to take a really long time.
Yeah, right. They're going to walk over my monster that I spent 3 hours making.
Yeah. And it's going to take them like 2 hours to do so. I mean.
Yeah, right. It's going to take a long time. We're all going to be tired.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not going to be satisfying for anyone. So you got to really, you know, all the lessons, like in Heroic, you can get away a lot more with not having terrain and, you know, because the characters are more kind of, you know, closer to the edge of succeeding or failing a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get away without using a lot of extra spice-free encounters. Like, that really needs to be your core in epic ones. You know, there needs to be hooks to more of this, or else it's just going to plow right through.
Right, right. Very, very good. So what's next?
I'm currently taking a tour of other game systems and doing some playtesting stuff, but then we have a plan tentatively sometime early next year to do some Dark Sun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we'll see from there. I also, you know, this is a bit of a plug, but I really want to do some character stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only did I make the ninja, it'd be cool to see someone play ninja.
Right.
but there's like a lot of the other stuff that's been coming out, you know, and that is coming out is really cool. And I've always liked the Oriental Adventure setting stuff and that style of play. So
yeah.
Very like good. to do something mini campaignish with that.
Sure. Are you sticking in the mini campaigns now? Is that a plan, or are you gonna go back to some larger campaigns?
I'm not sure yet. We're definitely gonna do some smaller campaigns first. I think Dark Sun won't be tiny, it won't be like six adventures, but it definitely won't be 3.5 years,
Right, right,
like
right.
shoot for 6 months or
I think
so.
yeah, I think mine was 12 to 16,
Yeah.
somewhere around there, and it was good. It was nice to have a solid arc. Good clean story arc that was level, I forget, 4 to 10 or 4 to 11 or something like that.
Yeah, and there's always the chance, like what kind of happened with, my campaign was we got through heroic and I expected to kind of do like a major change, but then it was like, oh, there's still enough interesting stuff here to do another 10 levels, so let's just stick around here. And that worked out really well. So it's always the case where you start out saying, okay, I'm expecting this campaign to just go for this many levels. Then if people are still into it and there's still stories to be told, it can always branch out from there.
Right. Well, very good. Appreciate your time.
Yep.
I think this
Thanks
will.
for interviewing
Oh,
me.
absolutely. I think I look forward to doing so again.
Yep. Sounds good.
Talk to you later.
Thanks.